More than 100 days after Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, at least 50% of the population still lacks electricity. And while the official number of deaths caused by the hurricane has been touted by Trump as being much lower than the number of deaths caused by Hurricane Katrina, the ongoing crisis on the island may change that. From lack of electricity, to inconsistent clean drinking water, to overburdened hospitals and many other life-threatening conditions have been caused by the lack of aid in the months following the storm. Freelance journalist Mattathias Schwartz recently wrote a piece based on his time spent in Puerto Rico that looks at the man-made disaster now playing out on the island. Through interviews with local residents and hospital employees, a picture emerges of an ongoing crisis that has the potential to worsen if conditions don't improve rapidly. The article, titled Maria's Bodies, was the cover story for the December 25th issue of New York Magazine and is their first feature to be translated into Spanish. I'm very pleased that it brings Mattathias to our show. Welcome.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. So you write in your article that the gap between the official body count and the reality on the ground may have hampered public health efforts during the hurricane's aftermath. So how? What do you mean?
Those initial body counts are really more of a measure of communication. You know, how quickly can the government get a handle on what's actually happening? Mm-hmm. But Trump sort of seized on them to make political hay and say, hey, this actually wasn't so bad. But that was very, very early in the process when he cited this number of 16 dead. And, you know, what I found is that the lack of electricity in Puerto Rico is really driving the mortality rate far higher. We know that for September and October, mortalities increased by about 20%. And we know that in New York City in August of 2003, when the electricity was just off for only 24 hours, that mortality went up by 28% citywide. So when the electricity is off, people begin to die, particularly in nursing homes and hospitals where you've got, you know, people who are attached to machines that are sustaining them. Respirators and oxygen and so on. And I talked to doctors who work in hospitals who were having problems with the electricity weeks and weeks after the hurricane had already come and gone. They still didn't feel like they had the infrastructure that they needed. So it's a and they still don't feel like that now.
Well, I want to get more into the electricity issue and the utility situation in a little bit.
But, oh, yeah, yeah.
But before we get too far into that, how does the amount of money and the number of personnel who were sent to Puerto Rico in the wake of this hurricane compare with what was provided on the mainland after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma?
Well, in terms of personnel, it's far lower. Mm-hmm. Harvey and Irma had 40,000 and 31,000 federal personnel deployed, respectively. For the hurricane in Puerto Rico, for Maria, it was a peak of 15,000. So that's, you know, half at the most. And now it's down to just over 5,000. So it's substantially less. I suppose if President Trump were on the line, he would say, well, it's a lot harder to get people down there.
Right.
It's an island. There's 1,000 miles of ocean. But from where I sit, that's a reason that the response should be even stronger.
Right.
You know, the president being in charge of one of the only institutions in the world that can make obstacles like that disappear in an instant if he were ready to make that commitment.
And how many people died in Hurricane Katrina?
I think it's the high estimate is 1,800.
Okay. And how much did Puerto Rico's overall mortality rate increase this past September and October as compared with the year prior?
So that 20% figure translates to about 1,060 additional deaths for September and October. And we're still waiting on what the final numbers will be for November.
Right.
So that's more than half of the high figure for Katrina. That's already been logged,
right.
As you know, additional deaths that you know, what, you know, any epidemiologist would chalk up to the storm.
So, getting back to the issue of electricity, statistically speaking, what impact does electricity consumption have on mortality rates in developing countries?
Well, let's see. There have been studies in Ghana that show that, yeah. So usually, if there's a substantial power outage, it'll increase by, you know, 20 or 30% over just a 24-hour period. And there are some areas now in Puerto Rico that have been without electricity for more than 100 days.
What areas of Puerto Rico are you referencing there? What
specifically,
parts of the
like
island?
It's just smaller communities that are further out from city centers. Mm-hmm. There's a big mountain city called Utuado that's kind of been a showcase for the Department of Defense in terms of showing that we're not just hitting the coastal areas, we're not just hitting the areas that are near our bases in San Juan and Aguadilla, we're also getting out into the countryside. But then if you drive, like, you know, 10 or 15 minutes outside Utuado, you will find plenty of smaller communities and neighborhoods that are rural and that still don't have, you know, electricity, or that whoever does have electricity is getting it from gasoline power generators that they've had to purchase and have to
which are very expensive. Those generators, they cost a
expensive
lot of money.
And then hospitals are also seeing a lot of injuries from the generators, from people who, you know, aren't used to using them,
right,
and are getting, you know, burned and scalded
properly.
and yeah.
This is Martha Plimpton, and I'm speaking with Mattathias Schwartz about his recent cover story, Maria's Bodies, in New York Magazine. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So, Mattathias, you describe a disturbing lack of attention paid to the concerns of Centro Médico. First of all, explain to us what Centro Médico is and why it's so important to this island.
So Centro Médico is the most important hospital in Puerto Rico. It's a short distance just outside San Juan. It's a complex of six different hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the emergency room, which is called the ASEM, which has an ICU and you know, an intensive care unit. And that is Puerto Rico's only Tier 1 trauma center.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a Tier 1 trauma center, you have to have a certain number of specialized doctors on hand who can deal with, you know, grievous injuries and deal with people who are on the brink of death.
So it's the only one on the island. Well, just for my edification, what's the square mileage of Puerto Rico?
I think it would be it'd be between 3,000 and 4,000 square miles.
Okay,
it's about it. Yeah.
Right. And what did Centro Médico, their CEO, made a request to the Department of Health and Human Services? What was that request?
Yeah, so the hurricane hit Puerto Rico. It hit everywhere, and it knocked a tree down, and that knocked out one of the generators that powered the ASEM, the emergency room in Centro Médico.
Mm-hmm.
The CEO. Actually, you know, thought that they only had 2 out of 3 generators that were still online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only sufficient to power the emergency backup. You know, it's some lights on, some plugs are on, the electricity is off, and the hospital gets hot very quickly. And then when those generators have to be taken off periodically for maintenance, there's actually, you know, full-on blackouts.
Right.
So the CEO of Centro Médico called the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, through FEMA and said, hey, we need you to come out here and give us another backup generator. And that was logged by FEMA and by the Army Corps and by Health and Human Services. But then they came out there. The request was made on September 22nd. They came out there on September 24th. But then they, for whatever reason, and I'm still not clear on this, they decided that another generator wasn't needed or that there were more pressing needs elsewhere. And then It took an entire month until October 22nd for that backup generator to be delivered. And in the meantime, the hospital experienced intermittent blackouts. There were times where there was no electricity at all, including one, you know, 30-minute period where the entire emergency room went dark. And, you know, there were doctors making Facebook videos showing how they're doing surgery, you know, by the lights on their phone. So you would think that if this were a priority, you would be able to get electricity to this hospital, which is not that far outside the capital, that it wouldn't take a month.
Mm-hmm.
But that's indeed what happened.
So it seems like the closest sort of explanation for the delay in getting this generator was one provided by someone you quoted, Thomas J. Field, who's an Army spokesperson for the Power Restoration Task Force. And you quote him as saying that just because you ask for something doesn't mean you're going to get it. FEMA has a responsibility to the taxpayer. But you know, and I could be wrong, yeah, here, but I'm pretty sure the residents of Puerto Rico are taxpayers, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. yeah. And I don't think, you know, I don't think, in fairness, I don't think he really knew what happened.
Okay.
I still don't know why this happened. And I think it kind of just got, for whatever reason, it got lost in the bureaucracy. But I called them several times and I told them what I'd found, and I've confirmed the chronology of this, you know, with the hospital and with, you know, U.S. government sources. And then the Army Corps also did a series of tweets that confirmed the same chronology. But we still don't know exactly what happened when, you know, people from the government came to the hospital on the 24th and said, you know, sorry, we don't have anything for you. And I still don't understand how they walked away.
Right. Well, even if it is, even if this quote of Mr. Fields is unrelated, it's still pretty jarring. I mean, to say that
FEMA
has a responsibility to the taxpayer, and yet and Puerto Ricans do pay taxes.
No, it shows a certain kind of us and them attitude that I think has permeated, you know, the rhetoric around the storm,
and also the response to it, apparently.
So yeah, absolutely.
Puerto Rico is considered an unincorporated territory. Can you explain to our listeners what that means?
Yes, Puerto Rico was part of Spain until we basically conquered it from them in a settlement in 1898. During the war with Spain. So unincorporated territories are under the authority of Congress, in the case of Puerto Rico, the island's inhabitants early in the 20th century became U.S. citizens,
mm-hmm.
but they do pay taxes, but they do not cast votes for the presidency,
right.
And they are not represented by a voting member of Congress. They have what's called a resident commissioner, Yennefer Gonzalez, who mm-hmm. you know, goes to Washington but doesn't cast votes.
Right.
So they kind of have this intermediate status. And I think the important thing to know about Puerto Rico, though, we have a few unincorporated territories. You know, Guam is one, and there are mm-hmm. some other Pacific islands. But these are tiny, 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 tiny islands with very small populations. Puerto Rico has more than 3 million people. And has a much higher population, a much larger group of people than any other of these unincorporated territories that are you know, under the control of the United States.
And in some ways, it's sort of internally run as though it were a state. It has a governor, it has mayors, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, but it doesn't have the you know, it doesn't have a voice within the federal government,
right?
It doesn't have, and then there are certain programs, like food stamps, for example, where Puerto Rico has to ask for special allocations of money mm-hmm. from, you know, from the federal government. It doesn't get the same benefits that it would if it were a full state, which is why Congress had to appropriate more than $1 billion in emergency, you know, food money after the storm.
Right.
And so that there are these other little differences. Also, Puerto Rican institutions and municipalities are not allowed to declare bankruptcy. Whereas, you know, U.S. cities and states can. And this is one reason that, you know, they've accumulated so much debt that they can't get out from under. And it's why Obama had to appoint to create an austerity board. There's like a board of seven governors who approve all the spending that most of Puerto Rico's government institutions now undertake.
Mm-hmm.
So the elected government of Puerto Rico does not actually have authority over what they spend.
Right.
You know, this federally appointed group has the final say, and on the island they call them the junta, and they sort of resent this. A lot of people resent that control.
Yeah. I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm speaking with Mattathias Schwartz for his recent cover story in New York Magazine called Maria's Bodies. Later on in the show, David Barba and James Pellerito with their film Anatomy of a Male Dancer, and Sarah Aziza, a contributor to Harper's Magazine, on the rise of feminist fitness in Saudi Arabia. You're listening to Midday on WNYC, and we'll be right back after a break. Hi, I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm speaking with Mattathias Schwartz about his article called Maria's Bodies, which is a recent cover story in New York Magazine about the death toll in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. So just for, Matatias, just for a little context, tell us about Hurricane San Ciriaco. Is that how you pronounce it, or Ciriaco? In 1899, there was a huge hurricane. And it was,
yeah, there was another devastating hurricane that actually killed an even larger number of people immediately. But it followed very much the same track,
right,
as Hurricane Maria across Puerto Rico, and it hit immediately after, you know, within months of the time that the U.S. had gained control of Puerto Rico from Spain,
mm-hmm.
And then there was just this massive relief effort. At the time, you know, by the federal government to try and get the island back on its feet, and also to try and sort of consolidate control and to, you know, realign the political order around U.S. interests in the wake of that storm.
And in terms of the response, the emergency response to Hurricane Maria, in contrast, let's say, for example, how many pallets of food and water was the mayor of San Juan supplied 3 weeks after the storm?
Yeah, I think what she told me is that she had only gotten, you know, a dozen pallets of food and water 3 weeks after the storm.
Wow.
And we saw the amount of time that it took took the federal government to send the U.S. Comfort, which is a 1,000-bed hospital ship. And that's something that President Trump only did, you know, after, you know, Hillary Clinton prodded him to do so on Twitter.
Right.
Because it was a pretty obvious thing to do that he didn't do. And he hasn't left that ship there. He actually ended the deployment and sent it back. And the New York Times did a great story that showed that while that ship was there, just because of red tape, they only really saw, you know, 6 or 7 inpatients a day,
mm-hmm.
on average during its deployment.
Right.
So the federal response has been it's been quiet and it's been a little bit disorganized. And if you look, you know, at this earlier storm, San Ciriaco, you know, which is, you know, all the more than a century ago, there was this huge effort to really demonstrate in a way that was, you know, a little bit patriarchal and patronizing and even racist. But at the same time, there was this big effort to dump all of this aid onto this new colony and show, you know, American dominance and the strength of, like, American empire. Mm-hmm. By trying to build this place back up. So
right.
I think what we're seeing now is almost kind of like a bookend to that, where, you know, it's too little too late, money's tight, and the message that we're sending to the world is that, you know, we don't really have the energy or the will to tend to, you know, the edges of our domain.
Trump has brought up Puerto Rico's debt as part of the reason for their current crisis. And yet, you know, as one of our callers mentions, that the citizens of Puerto Rico, who are American citizens, as we've said, have fought in U.S. wars. You know, I mean, these are people who participate in defending our country, or have participated in defending our country over the years. And yet, you know, the subject of Puerto Rico's debt becomes a sort of sticking point for the current administration. But you mentioned earlier this fiscal control board established in 2016 by Obama. So how does the island's debt impact its electric utility, which is called PREPA, I think?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's PREPA. You know, there are reports about the conditions of Puerto Rico's electric infrastructure that were made as a part of this, you know, as a part of this austerity settlement. And those reports show, one consultant described PREPA's condition as an emergency even before the storm,
mm-hmm.
And that they only had money to do the most, to not even do the most basic maintenance, that all they really had the money to do was to, like, stop intermittent blackouts. I mean, I think within the last 7 or 8 years, they had a blackout where there was 3 or 4 days without power across the entire island. So there have been plenty of warning signs that you know, that things are not right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can kind of, like, wash our hands of it and try and blame it on the island's administration. But as you said, they are a part of the United States.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think one reason that Puerto Rico's infrastructure is in such condition, and one reason Puerto Rico has so much debt, is that they haven't gotten, you know, the same kind of benefits from Congress that they would be getting if they were a state. And the simple reason for that is that they don't have a voice in Congress. They don't have the electoral votes. And so the two parties have no incentive to take care of them.
And then there are these new,
they've just been left
new,
on their own.
And in the new GOP tax plan, I imagine that that could actually end up getting worse because of the tax penalties that are going to be placed on Puerto Rican industry.
Yeah, the tax bill closes some loopholes.
That's right.
Which benefited the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And the medical device industry, which between those two things, that's about 30 or 40% of Puerto Rico's economy.
That's right.
Because of various tax arrangements, it makes a lot more sense for companies like Pfizer and Johnson and Johnson to make pills in giant plants in Puerto Rico than they would in the United States, and the Puerto Rican government incentivizes them to do so, and they don't have to pay the same kinds of taxes when they bring them back in that they would if they were making them overseas. And that's frustrating. That's something I heard from doctors, is that the electricity, you know, did not go off in those plants. And those plants have, you know, generators that cost millions and millions of dollars, and that they do not let those assembly lines sleep for very long.
It's actually affecting, just as a side note, life on the mainland as well in terms of shortages, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Things that were manufactured or are normally manufactured in Puerto Rico, where production has gone so dramatically down that we're seeing shortages here on the mainland of certain products, certain medical products.
Yeah, that's true of IV bags.
That's right.
In particular, I believe.
So because of the frequency of blackouts, how did Central Medico's emergency unit ultimately decide to use grid power from the utility, from PREPA?
So there were times where PREPA went back online, and then the emergency room would go back on the grid.
Mm-hmm.
But then the power continued to black out so much, even in San Juan, that they decided they would actually they would go back to generators, which are only supposed to be used for backup, because the grid would cut in and out. And then each time it cut out, there would be a minute or two where they'd have to switch to the generators. And that was so, you know, disruptive and also so harmful for the patient population that they actually decided they would use the generators as their first line for electricity and use the regular electricity as a backup.
So, and obviously this would severely compromise a doctor's ability to do their jobs, and, you know, operating on patients without electricity means compromised conditions in terms of sterility and all of this. Can you describe what doctors are dealing with in those terms?
Yeah, I had a doctor tell me that, you know, that he came to work the week after the hurricane, and he's named in the piece, and he just couldn't do anything because only, I think, 2 out of the 18 operating rooms were working.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real lack of there was no sterile conditions. The other thing to remember is that a lot of these doctors go home at night, and they don't have electricity in their own homes, you know, which means they don't have air conditioning, you know, which means that it might be, you know, well above 90 degrees if they're in like a condo and they're not getting good airflow. So you have doctors who aren't getting any sleep because they have to wake up, you know, 3 or 4 times a night and take a cold shower, you know, so they can get rest.
Right.
And I don't think anyone would want to be operated on by a doctor who's up against that at home. So it's really a drain on just kind of all levels of society, and we're really sort of seeing we're sort of setting a new low for what kind of care and what kind of infrastructure
seeing an increased risk in the possibility of an epidemic. So how close is Puerto Rico to experiencing something like that?
It's hard to say. I did talk to Doctora Ana Navarro, who she's a former attorney general of the U.S. She was born in Puerto Rico. And she said that, you know, at times she was very concerned, particularly because of the water supply. Mm-hmm. There have been a few dozen suspected cases and a handful of deaths from a disease called leptospirosis,
right?
Which comes from coming in contact with animal urine, sometimes through the water. In mountain communities, much of the water that Puerto Rico drinks is pumped through electric pumps. And in those places that still don't have electricity, those communities have switched back to getting water from mountain springs and PVC pipes. Health authorities say that that's not safe. A lot of people in those communities say that that water is actually better, you know, than what they're getting, you know, delivered by truck, which has been the sort of temporary backstop, you know, for the last, you know, 100 plus days, because the pumps aren't working. But yeah, all of this increases the chances of an epidemic when, particularly when people aren't getting, you know, good help through the water supply. And we saw that after the Haiti earthquake, there was a big cholera epidemic that was actually brought in by Nepalese aid workers who you know, set up a camp that polluted some of the water on a river. And so there are worries that that could happen in Puerto Rico. And then if we aren't keeping track of the number of people who are actually dying, you know, how long would such a thing go on before we even knew about it? That's a real problem.
I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm speaking with Mattathias Schwartz about his recent cover story in New York Magazine, Maria's Bodies. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So how did the Institute of Forensic Sciences deal with the rising death toll? What's the Institute's role in this ongoing crisis?
So the Institute of Forensic Sciences is part of the Public Security Bureau in Puerto Rico, and their job is to certify deaths and to say, you know, that so-and-so died by such and such a cause, and to submit those numbers to the Center for Disease Control in the United States. And so they have to sign off before someone's buried, before someone's cremated. And normally that's like very routine, but then immediately after the hurricane, there was like a flood of, you know, a flood of deaths, and then also like a flood of queries coming in, and it was more than they could handle. And they've been playing catch up since then. And part of that has been there have been trucks, additional coolers to hold the number of dead that were there for several weeks after the storm outside the Institute that were provided by FEMA, and were holding, you know, there were 12 of those trucks when I was there, and so those are sort of extra trucks to provide for the bodies of citizens that are beyond the Institute's existing capacity.
And so are they classifying these subsequent deaths or these additional deaths as cause unknown?
No, often they're being classified as natural causes.
Oh, I see.
Even those cases where it's clear that a lack of electricity is responsible for the person dying. I mean, I looked at some specific cases where people died who were on oxygen the night the power went out, and they got chalked up by the Institute as natural causes. Now, the governor of Puerto Rico has said that he's going to be reviewing those cases, and the Institute has said that anyone who comes to us and says this person was killed by Hurricane Maria will take another look. But it's been a pretty passive approach, that in the absence of any, you know, anyone poking them, they've been saying that people have been dying by natural causes.
Right.
And so that's how you get this big gap between this list of 60 Maria related deaths that the Bureau of Public Security has released versus the 1,000 plus increase in deaths that were seen, you know, in the demographic statistics, where there's this huge uptick in deaths on the island that aren't being reflected on the official list.
So because nature abhors a vacuum, and people, if there is no, you know, strong government response or infrastructure there or aid coming in, people are going to take matters into their own hands, and they're going to start, you know, playing the role of government in their own communities, you know, in a crisis. So tell us a bit about Millie. You write about a woman, a person named Millie, and how she ended up providing and organizing emergency services in her community.
Yeah, so Millie, she lives in a community called Villa Calma, which is most of the people who live there don't have deeds to their homes, but the homes are very well built. The community is well established. It's a little ways outside of San Juan. So she actually, when the storm was coming in, the community is very low to the ground, and there was a lot of flooding. So she actually took matters into her own hands and broke into a school that's one of the few sort of high-level, high-capacity structures there that's like two stories and would be safe from the flood. So she actually smashed the locks on the gates of the school and started, like, and completely on her own, organized and started a refuge or shelter for people, and found food for them. And then is since then has really emerged as like a leader. Like her house has become this aid depot. She's organized a community kitchen. She's mm-hmm. got like five different block captains who each have a water filter. So she's trying to get Biakalma back on its feet, even though there is still no electricity there. Right. And there's also been a real lack of any official aid, and whatever official aid has reached the community has been going through her house.
And you mentioned the word deeds earlier. We should talk about that, because it's FEMA will not apparently give aid or provide aid to homeowners if they cannot produce a deed. But many people, most homeowners on the island, don't seem to have deeds, and so they end up having to deal with this whole other complication. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think a lot of people do have deeds. I think the majority of homeowners do, but not in Biakalma. There are communities where people have made their own homes, and then this creates problems with FEMA, which often requires proof of ownership to mm-hmm. give more than a small amount of, like, about, I think, $500 of emergency money.
So people who build their own homes, which is a fairly large amount of people in the more you know, out of the way parts of the island,
yeah, and then
wouldn't
the
have
deeds
that
often,
kind of documentation,
right? And then they can't get deeds unless the local mayor and the municipality goes along with it, right. And that's often like takes a lot of wrangling and can be a pretty pretty politicized process.
So in the case of houses people that can produce deeds, what would be the average amount of money that FEMA would give them?
I'm not sure I know that. I did talk to someone who survived Hurricane George, who got, I think, $30,000 to rebuild his house. Mm-hmm. Although he did say that it took, 6 to 8 months. So some of this right. might just be, a typical bureaucratic delay. But then there also is, like, as you're saying, this mismatch where people don't have the documents that FEMA wants them to have, and so can't put through the help that people need. So in the absence of this, you have places where you'll have like 10 or 12 different people living in one home,
right?
Because for indefinitely, it seems,
right.
because the their own homes haven't been fixed and they don't have a prospect.
And in Millie's town, apparently people only got about $500 from FEMA.
Yeah,
right.
Those who did, that's what they reported. There was a census there, and a lot of people had gotten nothing, and then a small number had gotten $500.
Right, and right, okay. So
then she herself is actually, has a letter where she was denied FEMA aid. So FEMA, they've been through, but for whatever reason, it reminds me a little bit of this hospital. There's kind of yeah. like this mismatch between what the people there think they need and what our government's able to do for them.
Well, this is really fascinating, Mattathias, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Martha Plimpton, and I've been speaking with Mattathias Schwartz for his recent cover story in New York Magazine, Maria's Bodies. Thank you so much for joining me today and for talking with us about this.
Oh, thank you, Martha. Yeah, really happy to.
Thank you. Up next, David Barba with his new film, Anatomy of a Male Dancer. And for our latest Please Explain, we are taking your calls about your New Year's resolutions and whether or not you've broken them already, which you may have. You're listening to Midday on WNYC.